Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
Dear people of Aboriginal background of Australia,
prepare to be offended.
We apologize in advance for our horrible pronunciations of your name. Do not take offense.
Long, long time ago, 10 of us men went on the swamp to hunt the eggs of Kumang, the magpie goose. This young one was thinking wrong thoughts. So this old fella tell him a story. A story before a long time ago. Before we can remember. This story has too many wives, but not enough women. There's war in this story, and sorcery, and a belly as big as a mountain. There's wrong love, and there's wrong revenge.
I love you.
I love you.
Maybe it's a bad ending. Maybe it's a good one. It's not like your story. It's my story. My story you've never seen before.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is my co-host, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
This is my story. It's not your story.
Also back with us this week is Mr. Miguel Rodriguez.
But it is a pretty good story all the same.
This week we are talking about the 2006 Australian film 10 Canoes. Directed by Ralph Daher, this film is a multi-level tale of Aboriginal Australians. It's a story about stories. Proper stories that help people live the proper way. I'm purposefully leaving this a bit vague, as we'll be getting more into the story as we go along. But first, Miguel, as our guest, when was the first time you saw 10 Canoes, and what did you think?
Oh, gosh. I think I actually, you know, we were talking about Baltimore earlier. I believe I saw 10 Canoes at the Charles Theater in Baltimore, Maryland, probably the year it came out. So I think that was, what, 06? I just got off my festival, so I didn't do all the research I should have other than rewatching the film. I think this film is amazing. I really, really find it an exceptional journey. So I thought it then, and I think it even more now after rewatching it.
I had never seen this. As a matter of fact, outside of Bad Boy Bubby, which was Ralph Daher's film that we talked about on the Baby, Baby, Baby episode, I was not familiar with this filmmaker. So you really can't get further away from the other film. I mean, 10 Canoes looks like, in terms of story and ideas, was made by someone completely different than what you would expect for this other film that was about a guy who's, you know, kind of wandering around. Originally, you think sort of a post-apocalyptic world in Bad Boy Bubby, and then you realize he's dealing with the modern world and all of sort of being out of step with it. I was quite impressed, and it's one that I'd like to go back and watch again, because I don't know about you guys, but I kind of feel that at times whenever we're presented with people who are Native or Aboriginal or First Nations, however you want to do it, it often seems like it's a very fine line to tread. And sometimes it ends up being sort of this noble savage idea that, though, well, of course they're better than you because they live by the ancient ways. Or it becomes this thing where it's kind of offensive to their culture in a way. So, and I think in here it's just really kind of straight down the middle, and we get a great understanding of what that life must have been like and maybe still is.
You know, I have to jump in there and piggyback off you, Rob, because you kind of hit the nail on the head with the way the Aboriginal tribes are depicted here regarding whether or not, you know, the noble it's even hard to say noble savage or you know, the other way around, the kind of buffoonery or clown in the wild. But what I find fascinating about Ten Canoes is, even though you're looking at a group of people, and it's not even like present day Aboriginal tribes, we're looking at a period piece, and it's a layered period piece where we're seeing a group of Aboriginal tribes back years ago before any Westerners went to Australia, and they're telling a story about their own ancestors from years even before that. So it's not just Aboriginal tribes, it's Aboriginal tribes from X number of years ago. But all that being said, what we're presented with, the way they behave, the things that they care about, the way that they interact with each other, it's extremely relatable and familiar. I mean, they're, you know, making fun of the guy who farts, and they are talking about women, and it's all just kind of very human. And I think that's amazing. I think that was fantastically done.
I think I saw this one probably 2008, maybe 2009. I had seen Dr. Plonk, which I think I talked about on the Bad Boy Bubby episode as well. And that one just kind of blew me away. And then to find out that this guy who had done Bad Boy Bubby, and there was at least one other one, I think Incident at Raven's Gate, that I had seen before this as well. And then to go back and see 10 Canoes, which I think was streaming on Netflix at the time, just, oh my God. It, like you said, Rob, every single film feels like it's done by a different director when it comes to Ralph Daher's work. Like the style of it, the look of it, the subject matter of it. I mean, there's very few things that travel from film to film with him, and I think that's fantastic. And you would never know that the guy who did Bad Boy Bubby also did 10 Canoes, because, yeah, it does seem like worlds apart, though there are some similarities here and there as far as, like, you know, the outsider and all this kind of stuff. And I love the storytelling. Just the movie is a story about stories, and this multi-layered narrative is fantastic. And the one thing that I got out of it, the more I watch this film, the more I realize just how they're reusing some shots from one story to another, just to kind of pull things together to say, you know, everything that's happened before is still happening now and is probably going to happen in the future. Because we don't necessarily get a time frame for the outer story, that David Gopalil is narrating. Because he's telling this story about this tribe, and I don't think we necessarily get exactly when this tribe is there around. And then within that story, there's one guy telling a story to another tribesman, and he sets that tale all the way back at the beginning, all the way back, like just after, you know, the flood, just after Australia's formed. So kind of a story as old as time kind of thing. And to see that, you know, people were doing things then that they're still doing today, it's just one of these great ways of, you know, kind of subtly driving things home when you look at something and you're like, well, that's the same thing that they were doing earlier. And then you realize, oh, that's the exact same shot, just one is in color and one is in black and white.
One of the things also with the storytelling device of him doing the voiceover and being the narrator is I got this feeling of like being around a campfire kind of thing. And there's an aspect of it that as I was watching it, I thought, you know, could he have done this without the subtitles? And I think at times it could be done, but I think some of the nuances would have been missed. I was thinking of something like when I saw Malick's The New World, where those who were of the tribe were not subtitled. When they were in conversation with each other and they were not in conversation with the English, you had no idea what they were saying. But you could, it was implied, you could understand it based on their interactions among each other. And I think it would be a different film that way. But I was sort of thinking to myself, it is such a film that I think to a certain extent, and the visuals are important, but it's almost with his narration that you could just listen to his narration. It's almost like a radio play or something like that for me.
Because we have the subtitles, we're invited to be part of the tribe. And that's what separates this film from The New World, Terrence Malick's The New World, in Malick's The New World, as great as Terrence Malick is in that film is, the natives in that film still seemed very much kind of the other, even though you see them interacting with each other. You can kind of discern what they're thinking and how they live their lives. You're still apart from them. And I think one of the points of Ten Canoes was to invite you in and make you part of the tribe and experience the things along with them. So I actually do personally like the subtitles. And, you know, there are funny things, the way jokes that they tell each other, the way they rib each other, that really only work when you can get some kind of translation for what they're saying rather than just have David Gulpalil narrate it.
Yeah, like I said, I wasn't advocating for that version of the film. I was just saying that if it was done that way, I think it would be still an interesting watch.
Oh yeah, that's definitely true. It's fascinating. The visuals make it so engaging.
So just to kind of carry on what we were talking about with the layers of storytelling. So we start in color with David Gulpalil's voice coming up and being this narrator. And luckily he's kind of, to your guys' point, he's a very engaging narrator and he is there with us a lot. So it's not like you're going through long periods of this film and saying, what happened to the narrator? This is kind of odd. Like, he's there to walk us through a lot of this stuff. He helps us explain a lot of this stuff. But then we also get the story within the story because we have then the other storyteller. And he's basically helping take the place of the other storyteller at times because he's explaining what the storyteller is telling us. God, try to imagine that sentence right there. So there's this Malingaloo who's telling the story to Dayindi. And Dayindi, I believe, is being played by, I'm not 100% on this, but I think he is David Gulpalil's son or relative because he has the same last name and another name. Because David Gulpalil is being credited in this film as David Gulpalil Richmond. Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. Any Aboriginal people that are listening to this, Ridgemar Maril Dalithgulnu, and this other guy is Jamie Dayindu Gulpalil Dayithgulnu. So very similar names. God, I feel terrible for stumbling over these.
You know, can I just have to say I love these names.
Oh, they're so musical.
Exactly. They're so musical. And I feel like they're full of dignity. You know, these multi-syllabic names. Every time they say it in the film, and I notice the narrator, when he's introducing characters, will say the name twice, pretty close on its heels. So he'll say, this is, you know, Ridgemaril. And then he'll say, Ridgemaril does this and this and that. And I noticed that was a kind of a common theme of repeating these names. And it does end up rather musical, song-like.
We've got David Gulpalil as the storyteller on the outer side. Then in the inner side, we've got Mingaloo telling the story to Dayindi. And he's telling this story of Ridgemaril, who has all these wives. And the younger brother of Ridgemaril, who is Yiparil, he is lusting after one of his brother's wives, which is the same thing that's happening in this outer story. And it's nice that we go from this vivid color of David Gulpalil's world to black and white, which is our framing device, our main framing device here, with the storyteller and them going out and making these canoes and coming back and they're hunting geese and doing all this kind of stuff. He's telling this story to this younger man, and it's basically relating the exact same thing because the younger man in this story is kind of lusting after another woman as well. And then that middle story, the heart of the film, we've got in brilliant color again. So it's kind of nice that the past is actually the vivid stuff. It's not that kind of trope that we've talked about on the show before where anything in the past is automatically in black and white.
I was trying to figure out these multi-layers of which, you know, when to go to color, when to go to black and white, because it doesn't really seem all that standard of what we're used to with other films.
I thought that was actually a nice touch, and it does help kind of separate what is going on when we're in the storyteller mode and when we go back to ancient times. And I thought it was a great way to show how the story that the storyteller is telling is the important part here. That the story itself is what lends our lives power, and that's kind of symbolized by the vivid color and brilliant cinematography and lighting of the far, far past. I mean, some of those shots are they really come to life in comparison to when the group of tribe is, you know, stripping the bark off the trees to make canoes in the middle section or the framing device section.
And then we go one level deeper. You know, this is the our inception moment, I suppose, here, where we have within that middle story, we have one more level, which is that these guys that are in this tribe are often proposing things. Like, there's multi discussions where they're talking about what happened to the one guy's wife, what happened to Ridge Morell's wife. And each of them kind of has their own story as to what they think had happened. They meet this stranger and they think about, okay, what's going to happen with this stranger? And they each have this proposition. And in those times, we go to this kind of desaturated color. So it's like another story within there, because we see each of their versions of these different things. Like, hey, let's go attack this other tribe. How are we going to do it? Let's do it at night. No, that's a stupid idea. But yet they show what the attack would look like when it happens.
Yeah, it's almost like Rashomon, only instead of different perceptions, it's different ideas being actually reenacted.
And I love that kind of stuff, because that happens in a lot of my favorite comedies, where it's like, you know, what would happen if this were to take place? And then you kind of snap back into reality and you're like, oh, okay, no, we haven't done that yet. You know, it's almost like a dream sequence, but just usually it's a little catchier, funnier, and quicker. And these are very quick. I mean, some of these cuts in here are very fast, and you wouldn't necessarily expect that from a, you know, like, I think of something like Animals Are People Too, like, where they're talking about the Bushmen of the Kalahari, and that's very languid in their storytelling a lot of times. And so this is like very much the opposite. Just like these quick cuts, a lot of close-ups and everything, and I love the way that so many people just address the camera directly.
It's very intentional whenever the storytelling pacing is sped up or slowed down to a more deliberate pace. And sometimes, particularly the way the story is actually delivered explicitly through narration, he will give pauses between lines and really slow it down. And they even explicitly address that by saying, this is where you learn patience, you know. And then there are the times you're talking about, particularly where they have these reenactments of what could happen or what may have happened. And you're right, it's almost like Family Guy, where they have a random act and they'll cut to show what the random thing is and they'll cut back to the present time. It might be a minute tops of some kind of action happening.
You mean like the time you had tea with Muhammad, the prophet of the Muslim faith?
Come on, Muhammad, let's get some tea.
Try my Mr. Tea.
And I love that the story within the story, like the core of everything, it's so funny to me because so much of it hinges on two things that happen. One, a stranger comes to camp. So everybody kind of freaks out about this stranger coming to their camp. And apparently he doesn't approach the right way. He doesn't warn them that he's about to be there. So they kind of turn around and see this guy. And it's just like, you know, okay, that's not the right way to do it. And really, again, so much of this movie is about teaching you the proper way. This guy does not come to camp in the proper way. And then the other thing is, this woman who goes missing, one of the wives who goes missing, and it's the wife who was the object of the one guy's affection and, you know, was the other guy's wife. And it's just, you know, so much of it becomes like this paranoia. It's almost like the monsters are on Maple Street kind of thing, where it's just like they start blaming everything on this stranger. How dare he come in here? You know, this is, everything is going wrong. There's a sorcerer that lives in their camp who, well, kind of stays out of the fray a little bit, and he's right there to prey on all of their fears and just starts selling all this malarkey about, you know, yeah, the stranger's going to come in, he's going to steal your shit, like literal shit, and then your stomach's going to blow up and you're going to explode.
So this guy's a politician is what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah, very much.
Stoking the fear.
I'm not saying that all of the strangers are bad, but they tend to send their worst people to our camp.
We should have no amnesty for strangers in our camp.
Should build a wall around our camp to keep those strangers out.
That's right. They should get guns, and then that way they wouldn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, these spears, they're old school. They really need to get some guns.
Wow. You know, you mentioned that this film is a story about storytelling, and I think that's very true. But I think I'll go one farther, and I'll say that this is this film is a story about traditional storytelling in a very old world sense, where stories were parables that showed us how to behave. And I think that all of this paranoia about the stranger that you're talking about, it's in the story that, oh, goodness gracious, here we go. I'm not going to attempt the name, but in the framing device, it's in the story that's being told to the younger brother. And it's almost another lesson that's learned is see what comes of this kind of paranoia, this kind of rash thinking and jumping to conclusions, because there are some consequences that result from this.
Yeah, definitely. Very bad things happen when it comes to this. And I love, too, that framing device. So, you know, outside of David telling us the story, this framing device of the expedition out to make these canoes and everything, that story being told takes place over a number of days, and that we get the other tribesmen making fun of the storyteller about how long it's taking him to tell this story. And you mentioned before the whole value of patience and everything. And I just love that it's like we are there with these people over a number of days, though, of course, it's condensed into 2 hours worth of movie time. But that is a beautiful idea that you go out on this expedition with these guys, with your tribesmen, and you have the one guy who's there just telling this elaborate tale over the whole period of time. It's just like, wow, that must, you know, if you were there, that must have been really something.
Well, and they do mention as well that, you know, they strip the trees of this particular kind of bark that they can make canoes from. And then they have to submerge the bark in the waters of the swamp to help get it to a malleability. But the distance between the trees and the swamp is quite far. So there are all these opportunities as these men are walking and doing this kind of very automatic kind of labor, where it would be quite a boon to them to have a storyteller among them passing the time in this way.
I mean, why don't they just listen to their iPod or something? I mean, come on. Play with their phone.
They're walking through the forest and the swamp and just looking down, checking their status. That's right. It's hard. Still in the swamp. Hashtag bored.
It's hard to keep your iPhone when you have no pants.
Yeah, if you are afraid of full frontal male and female nudity, this is not the movie for you.
Although in terms of the framing, he does it's not like he dwells on it. So it's just like, all right, there's a guy in a long shot and he happens to be naked, but when they move towards the camera, it's like you're up to, you know, chest height or whatever. So it's, you know, there's none of that. I mean, it's like if you grew up as a kid reading National Geographic magazine, it's like, whatever.
It's filmed with appropriate nonchalance in that regard. It is what it is. And it does bring up very interesting perceptions that these people have that, you know, Mike just mentioned the whole covered prick thing. There's a very different way that the characters approached any kind of coverings. And in fact, the stranger had a more, shall we say, modest loincloth, not that much more, but enough that was part of what made them immediately distrust him, is that his genitals were slightly more covered than theirs. And, you know, they went on to say, why is he covering up? Is it small? Never trust a guy with a small prick. I mean, all of these prejudices started coming up, and it was explicitly about what he was wearing. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, they have nothing really to go on with this guy, so they immediately start jumping to all these conclusions, which just, again, kind of that xenophobia. You know, he is just from another tribe, and in our eyes, our Western racist eyes, it's like, well, you guys all look alike to me. Come on, you know, what's the difference? But to them, it was a huge difference in the way that he was partially dressed over the way that they're dressed, the way that he had his hairstyle, the way that he had like the mud on his face, these kind of things. Whole world of difference to these guys. You stay with your tribe, you have the mark of your waters, these kind of things. You do not stray outside of that. So they are like very willing when it comes to different tribes and stuff, like, okay, we're going to go to war with this tribe. We'll talk about going to war with this other tribe, and very much, again, trying to stay within what is the proper way. And even when there's a murder that happens in this film and then a kind of redemption around the murder, the world was in balance with the murder, and then they have to now make things right, and they have to go back to that proper way.
Yeah, there are lots of rites that are observed in this film. You know, I kind of want to digress slightly here on your point about the conclusions they're jumping to, and more specifically about how they view each other's differences, and they have their own xenophobia amongst themselves that wouldn't necessarily be as perceptive to someone from the outside like us. And like you said, our racist ideas, like what's the difference, right? I mean, I can imagine very easily someone having that reaction. And that's, I think, is the beauty of cinema, is that it can communicate this kind of idea that people have identities all over the place, and those identities can be very strong, and sometimes it can lead to, you know, some, let's shall we say, conflicts. But, you know, here's an example is just this past weekend, I had a filmmaker who lives in Tokyo, and she flew into my film festival, and she was telling me she went to another film festival in Utah. And I don't want to bag on Utah, but she was telling me stories about how she would go out to the bar afterward and try to show her ID. And the people were like, what's this, in Chinese? And she'd say, no, it's Japanese. And they would respond with, oh, it's all the same. And you know, I found that like rather unthinkable that that still happens, but it's the same concept in a way, you know, that what an outsider or someone from another country will, or our country will perceive as being the same, it's quite different amongst the groups themselves. You know, a Japanese person and a Chinese person certainly don't want to be confused with each other in general.
You talked about ritual and the whole idea of, you know, as I was talking about making things right and everything, and that ritual at the end. I mean, I think that's probably, it feels like it's one of the longer sequences of the film, the whole idea of what happens to Rich and Merrill. And that to me is one of the most beautiful sequences of the whole film. Just the way that it's shot, the way that the story is being told at that point, the music. I mean, especially when David Gopalil starts talking about the way that the music is coming into it, you know, and now the drums and now the didgeridoo and all that, and just getting all of those layers and then seeing Rich Morrill doing his whole thing. It's like, wow, this, you know, it's because so much of the story is told, well, I can't say it's told straightforwardly, but as far as like, there's not a lot of like, you know, tricks and, you know, camera craziness, you know, we're not dollying in from 500 feet away into anything. There's that really great scene when those spears are being thrown at Rich Morrill and his brother, and they're moving so fast and dodging these things so much that they're basically, you know, it's like a double exposure of those guys and the spears just passing right through them. I love that bit. And that's probably the most you know, trickery, quote unquote, that we get in the film and everything else. There's probably a lot of other trickery going on, but so much of it is in advancement of the story that I don't even necessarily notice it. But when it comes time to call attention to some of the more cinematic moments, I mean, that end sequence there is just so lovely, and it really kind of, you know, puts a fine point on the way that the film, the actual literal film, is being used to tell this story.
Yeah, there is it's a very documentary feel, except for those moments where the story has a real turning point, like the Makarrata with the throwing of the spears, and of course the probably what has to be the moment with the most weight is the passing of Riji Muriel's soul from the earth to the sky, which requires almost being led through the songs of his tribesmen. And as well as, you know, all kind, I think they paint the symbol of his water hole on his chest, so his soul can find his water. All these things are observed with solemnity, as well as, like you said, more cinematic flair. Particularly the dance. The dance is just magically shot with the lighting and it's slow motion, and the way that the bodies move is, it's a really, really well crafted scene. This film is so there's a lot of reflection rather than, I don't know, a lot of complicated storytelling. So it really does. The experience of this film hinges on sitting down and letting the location wash over you. In fact, that is, and it starts off that way. The film opens with this flowing overhead. I guess it must have been a helicopter shot just going over Australia and the wilderness. And it's really gorgeous. And that's kind of the way the film goes for the rest of that moment on, is just immersing you in the locale and the time and a very different culture than you might be used to.
That opening is gorgeous, and that does kind of call attention to itself, but it does build that world so well for us that we just kind of are exploring this northern part of Australia. You can say, like, okay, all forests look alike, but no, I've never seen any landscape that looks like what we see in Ten Canoes, except perhaps in other Australian films. But even the way that it's being shot, it doesn't look like other Australian films. You know, I've seen Walkabout, I've seen, you know, Rabbit Proof Fence, these kind of things. This has a very distinct look to it.
The other thing that I like in here, beyond we were talking about the use of color, is the use of close-ups in the, I think it's probably about 10 minutes, 15 minutes in, where he starts introducing all the various people in the tribe. And it's sort of these almost like close-up portraiture thing where you watch them and then their expression kind of changes a little bit as the camera lingers on them. It's kind of the concept, in a way, for me as I was watching it, of like the old Warhol screen test idea, that if you put a camera on someone long enough, then I guess their true personality comes out in some way, because they have to react to this thing in their face. So although these people who are playing these characters or these individuals in this story are not technically on camera, if you know what I mean, like there's no camera in this society, but there's something about holding on them, and then we get this sort of personality come through. There's like a laugh or a smile or something that seems to come through as we're introduced to these various people.
I like that we get echoes of that as we go through this, because we get those close-ups of these people as we're going through, and then we get those again, like when they put on their war paint, and we get, okay, now here are these people again, and, you know, going around that circle. We get a lot of that, like going around the circle of who these people are and their opinions about things, and it's just like, oh, okay, this is pretty cool. And, you know, we get their individual personalities through that, because you could easily be like, you know, because yes, we're having trouble struggling with some of these names and everything, but we know every character by the end of this film. We have been introduced to them and they all have something distinctive about them. And luckily it's not like, you know, I mean, of course, yeah, like this is the fat guy who loves honey, but there's more to that character and what he, the role he plays inside of the story. And I really kind of appreciate that too.
Yeah. And that's the least subtle one too. I mean, the rest of the characters and their personalities and the things that set them apart from each other are far more subtly done, particularly with Reggie Merrill and his younger brother. And that's one of, like, that goes back to what I was saying before about how human they are in the way they act with each other, and how that can be a contrast to how indigenous people are portrayed in other films or similar films.
This could have easily gone bad. And fortunately, it didn't. You know, it is very respectful of these people throughout the entire film. At least that's the way it feels. And, you know, like we talked about, like, oh, yeah, there's a fart joke in the beginning and everything. Yeah, but it's basically showing these people are humans. You know, they laugh, they cry, they fart, they do all this stuff. They are very, very human. So it's not like walking anthropological sketches of people.
Right. I mean, the fart joke is done in such a way that it's not a buffoonish moment. It is a, look, these are a bunch of dudes doing their work together. It's like construction workers on a construction site. It seems familiar. And it opened, we're introduced to this group that way. And, you know, they're walking and then the fart joke happens at the very beginning of the film. This is our welcoming into their space, because it could seem to us a bit alien and a bit other and a bit unwelcoming. But when the opening scene is, hey, this guy farted, he needs to walk at the back of the line, that invites us in. You know, it lowers our guard, I think. I thought that was brilliant.
Right. And they're just busting his balls like every group of guys ever, you know, like, oh, man, you're rotten on the inside. And they're like, yeah, I'm rotten. All right. We're going to take a break and play a pair of interviews. The first is a continuation of our interview with Ian Jones from our Baby, Baby, Baby episode, where we covered Bad Boy Bubby. The second is a talk with the director of Bad Boy Bubby and 10 Canoes and so much more, Ralph DeHaere. We'll play both of those after these brief messages.
Hello from Cinema Detroit, Metro Detroit's only truly independent cinema. We deliver an eclectic mix of current indie, genre, cult, and classic movies in the heart of the city. Like a sommelier choosing wine for his or her guests, we handpick our slate of films, many of which are exclusive to the metro area, the state of Michigan, or occasionally the entire Midwest region. Cinema Detroit features a unique setting in a former school and a warm hometown atmosphere, including always fresh popcorn, Detroit-made Faygo soda, and other locally created treats. Please visit our website, cinemadetroit.com, for the latest features and showtimes. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Tumblr. We look forward to seeing you soon at 3420 Cass Avenue in Midtown Detroit, 48201.
Let me ask you a question. Are you getting enough? I bet you'd love more, right? Well, AdamandEve.com wants to give you more with 10 free gifts. First, you'll get a sexy surprise for her. Second, a specially selected toy for him. And third, a little something we know you'll both enjoy. Plus, you'll get 6 full-length adult movies on DVD. And number 10, free shipping on your entire order. So what do you have to do to get your 10 free gifts? It's not hard. Just go to AdamandEve.com and select any one item. It could be an adventurous new toy, sexy piece of lingerie, or anything you desire. Just enter offer code BOOTH at checkout, and you'll get all 10 free gifts. Go check out AdamandEve.com today. Select one item and get 10 free gifts, including free shipping, when you enter offer code BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
When a director comes to you and says, this is how I want to shoot something, how much of it is their vision versus you having to make this happen versus you kind of injecting yourself and bringing something to life as far as how a movie is going to look?
He's a DOP. The DOP or DP is definitely, if you don't bring something to the table, you know, it's nonsense. You must bring something to the table. You must bring, when you read the script, you take on a vision. It's sort of part of, I think, your responsibility. There's this vision. Now, whether there is also going to be examples of that vision or examples of how things perceivably could look or the direction certain camera angles may go in or the breaking down of all this, what we call the look, you know, is contributed by light, contributed by lenses, contributed by the camera, obviously the cast as well. I believe, you know, costuming has an amazing contribution to all that, and of course the location where you place it. So there's always elements, but I think you, as a DP, you need to bring certain parts of that. And, of course, your director is as well, because they've either got a passion for films that they've seen in the past and went, wow, that really stands out. I'd like to see that and that. And I think then it becomes an amalgamation a little bit of both of you bringing those elements into fruition. You know, I can't remember which film, but it's a bit like, if I remember, probably Tracker was probably, let's just shoot it on a, you know, basically a 50mm anamorphic lens and never change lens and just see what we can make. And I mean, Rolf even brought that up. And in fairness to a DP, you go, yeah, I'm happy with that challenge. I can make that work. Because, you know, you don't get these opportunities very often because sometimes they can be, you know, can be a little bit more regimented than that. That didn't happen. I think we ended up with using two lenses. I think it was a 50 and a 75 anamorphic. But you do anyway in anamorphics. You don't have a great range of primes. And by nature, it tends to fall into those categories of 50, 75, 100 possibly. So, no, with Rolf Tracker, I definitely created. That was probably a film that I, in Australia here, the rest of the world's the same, but you either had choices. I think at one stage we had Kodak, Agfa and Fuji, and Agfa went away, and so there was Kodak and Fuji. And Kodak, I've always, in my mind, thought it was always sort of biased in the red area. And a lot of early Australian outback films have always been quite red, and you get this red nuance through the film, which, that's fine. We put it down to the red outback, and we put it down to, you know, the heat of the sun, I dare say, the colour of the sun, and so forth, and that's been accepted. Yet when you look at some of our early painters, and particularly Albert Namatjira, who's a very early Indigenous Australian painter, he had the mauves and the purples and the whites, the quite, not vivid whites, but really strong, I'll call them powdery whites, in his paintings. And I've always admired that, and quite honestly, a late afternoon can actually have a lot of those hues of the mauves and the purples in. So having worked with Chris Doyle, I operated and did second unit. I did Steadicam and second unit on Rabbitproof Fence, and Chris Doyle shot main unit. And I was quite integrated into that camera department with Chris and Phil Noyce, and that's because of my past connection with Phil. what Chris Doyle has done has really, to me, thrown a lot of values, tossed them up in the air, and you just grab a few of those and say, look, I like that and I like that idea, but I don't. That's been very traditional. I don't want to go that way. And Chris does this all the time. He's quite a extraordinary sort of gentleman. And so he was doing things on Rabbit Proof Fence, which I probably hadn't experienced before with previous DOPs that I've worked with or DPs that I've worked with. And so I took some of those on board, and Tracker was a result that I really loved and saw finally a film in my mind that didn't have these red bias about. And I'm very happy with the result of Tracker, of how we approached that. It was a film shoot. It filtration, the way they went with filtration gave me a look. So much so, we were quite isolated. So our rushes, or dailies as you would call them, our only way of me knowing how things really went was the next, our rushes were 2 days behind, or dailies were 2 days behind. I would ring every day, but I was ringing about dailies that were 2 days previously. And so the word was coming through from the laboratory at the time saying, there's just this great look about it. It's got this real, and they said it, they said it's got this real Albert Namatjira look. And I went, yes, that's gold. And so I was very happy with that approach. Things like money is always an issue with budgets, with smaller budgeted films. So for me, we needed to work at different times of the day. I did things like I made sure in the budget there was enough money to cover pushing and pulling of the stock, which meant that I could rate it at any ASA rating that I chose. So I chose one stock. I said, okay, I can push and pull this as much as I want. And that gave me flexibility early morning, late afternoon and midday. So it was just an enjoyable film from the point of view of being able to play with filters a bit more than I have in the past, probably, and also play with the stock, which, in fairness to Chris Doyle, set that example to me on Rabbit Proof Fence.
You talked a little bit about The Tracker. I have to say that I love the look of that film. I really love the look of Ten Canoes.
What happened with Ten Canoes was that, again, budget-wise, there were restrictions, and lighting-wise for Tracker was very minimal lighting. We were quite very isolated in different mountain ranges at a place called Arkarua. So getting generators, part of the Rolf de Heer story with the sound recorders, a guy, a gentleman by the name of James Curry, is the problem with generators, they make noise, even if, you know, you hear them, and if you're in a close valley, you definitely hear the noise of the generator. So a lot of Tracker is shot with at that time, quite primitive in portable lighting power. So it was reflective boards, white sheets, and the occasional sun gun, which we had. There's a night sequence in, and we shot the night sequence was four, I think, night sequences. We shot over four nights. We shot literally in the same area. As you probably appreciate, at night you don't quite know where you are. So I bought in a helium balloon for that so we could condense the cost. So it's allowed the luxury of the helium balloon. And we shot in and around that balloon. We did have generators then, and so we very much compressed what we required and needed for those four sequences. When it came to Ten Canoes, a couple of shifts took place. It was the digital intermediate had come about, and I sort of approached Rolf and said, look, we'd be nonsense if we didn't look at this digital intermediate. There is a cost, and it's quite an expensive cost, but it gives us so much power in post that, you know, we can play with the images and give it, you know, something that we potentially couldn't get out of Tracker. And he hummed and hawed about that for a while, and he came back to me and said, well, we can't afford it. They've done their sums. And I said, okay, fair enough. And then the film got deferred for a number of different reasons. And so the time I'd been spoken to the time I actually shot it, I think it might have been about 3 years even. I'll say it was 2 years. By that stage, the digital intermediate had come a long way. We had a laboratory. We had a number of laboratories in Australia, but one in particular we were going to probably use out of Sydney. They had made the transition. They'd moved physically their premises, and when they moved, they actually didn't. They moved straight into the digital world, and they didn't to do a any effects on film. They weren't using the Oxbury anymore. It was all going to go down the data path. So they actually met Rolf halfway and said, look, we can subsidise this film for your DI because that's where we're going anyway. You're asking for some effects, which we probably can't deliver you through the Oxford system. It has to be data anyway. So that was the first 4K out film in Australia, and that was through a deal that happened with the laboratories. And as you probably appreciate, being the black and white and the colour, the amount of layers that have to take place to deliver that is quite difficult. And then there was the subtitles involved with that as well. So in effect, the film, we all benefited by everyone compromising. It was just great, and you know, and sharing the costs basically. So that gave us that look of that film just by the nature of everyone working in that post area and delivering. There was a French gentleman who can't think of his name right this second, who was the colorist on the film, and at Lab is where the film was post-produced, and he did a sterling job. We sat with him, Rolf and I sat initially, and then I sat with him. And his feeling for what we should manipulate, what we shouldn't manipulate, was true to the story, and my heart goes out to him. As a DP, you probably want to change every image, but as we all know, the film does have to have its own life, and that's what we pursued and endeavoured to deliver.
You mentioned The King Is Dead. I haven't had a chance to see that one or Charlie's Country yet. I've been waiting for those to finally be available here in the States.
Yeah, so The King Is Dead, yeah, it was a film that Rolf, to some degree, has a story or has some sense of the story through things that he's been associated with in his life. So that's the basis of the story, I dare say. And it was, do we shoot a film or do we go data? And then Rolf, I don't know why it came about, but he decided that we could probably shoot it on a 7D or a 5D. And I went, oh, really? and in fairness for any DP, you've got to take the most of your opportunity. So I went, okay. And I took that on board purely because I felt that, one, there's budget restrictions. I don't necessarily always ask what the budget is. I'm aware of what money that I'm probably going to have available to me and what I can cover in that area, that's equipment as well as crew. But I tend not to get involved with the other areas. You can take on board issues you don't need to. So I think it can cloud your vision sometimes. So I tend not to, and I have faith in Rolf and the way it works. So The King Is Dead was probably a little bit different because of the nature of what we're going to use. And it was definitely out of Rolf's knowledge regarding the data world and the implications and the complications and some of the things that expected or maybe taken as being understood, but they're not understood and they can later on bone you. I mean, it's a simple case of just transferring data, whose responsibility that is, and if it's going to go to an editor, or is it going to go via a post house, or are you going to set up post people, you know, there's always questions that need to be asked. So so in some ways, by Rolf stepping into this data world, he grew a lot of knowledge. So that was a learning curve for both, but it was equally me passing a lot of information on to him and asking how he wanted to go about these areas, which previously weren't an issue in the film world. I mean, the films, you shot some film, it just definitely got, you know, went from a magazine into a can off to a laboratory and they took over the process. But if you've not been in this transition time, which to some degree still exists a little bit, but when people haven't been associated with it, it is actually quite difficult and tricky to understand. So The King Is Dead we shot on a 7D in the end. I opted for a 7D over a 5D, and that had to do with the degree of focus. I find a 5D just very critical in the focus area. And the 7D seemed to be able to deliver the things that I needed, so that's where we sat. We actually had a good, I think they were the bottom of the range CP spherical lenses. They worked quite well. The film itself hasn't really gone anywhere. That can be a number of reasons, but in Australia here, the company that distributed the film were not the people for the film. They thought they'd bought a different film than what they had actually bought. And so when the film finally got released, I think it got released in one cinema in the other side of the country at Western Australia. That was their obligation. Rolf with a lady called Kathy, can't remember Kathy's surname. She was the publicist with Rolf. They, on their own back, made sure it got released in Sydney and in Melbourne, but it didn't. Not many people really got to see it, unfortunately.
Now, I did hear about Charlie's Country when it was going around to the different festivals. It sounds like that one definitely had more of a festival life. I don't know how that one did in theaters.
I'm not sure myself, I'll be quite honest. I haven't really followed that through. Rolf's actually still on the circuit in Europe at the moment with that film. I did go to Cannes with him, and it got a good reception there. David Gokul won Best Actor there in Uncertain Regard, which, you know, that's fantastic for him and fantastic for the film. Yeah, it is. I suppose it's got a message. It's a very contemporary message in modern, or for the modern world, I suppose, but it's also very contemporary message for modern white Australia, and that's sort of the film, where the film sits, basically. It will be seen and be viewed by, and you're probably right, in the festival circuit, but it will be screened and viewed in the education circuit as well, because it's got some very interesting straight up and down points to be made about how Indigenous Australian is conceived and rules and regulations are put into place. With no thought to other issues, basically.
You have definitely shot David Gokul almost more than anybody else, I think. What does he like to work with?
David. No, he's a lovely man. He's a very lovely man. When you see Charlie's Country, you'll know David Gokul. Because in some ways, as much as it shouldn't be spoken about, it is in truth sort of the things that have happened to David over the time of his contact with white Australia and his life with them in the film industry in a lot of ways. The things that have gone on in his life are very much portrayed in Charlie's Country.
It's been interesting watching him grow up on film, you know, seeing him in Walkabout all the way up till now and being able to see him age as an actor and as a human being.
Oh, no, absolutely. But, you know, David is the classic of, you know, he was found, you know, I won't say in the bush, but he was found in the bush, and now where he fits within the modern world, it is tricky for David. There's no doubt about that.
What is Force of Destiny?
Force of Destiny was a film that, so I work with at this point in time. I'm being lucky enough to do films for two Dutch directors in Australia, Paul Cox and Rolf de Heer. And Paul Cox is a gentleman who's done, I suspect, about 24 films in Australia. He's probably got 50 pieces of bodies of work that covers documentaries and so forth. And I've been lucky enough to be involved with his last four, maybe five. And Force of Destiny is the last film that he's about to be distributed, about to be released. And it's a it's a love story. Well, Paul, his scripts are very emotive, normally boy-girl relationships and very emotional relationships. And this story takes place with a liver transplant victim and a lady he meets during that process that happened to be Indian. And so we shot it in Melbourne, Victoria, and country Victoria. We also shot in India in Kerala, in the province of Kerala, in the state of Kerala. We finished that earlier this year. We finished that about April, maybe.
I'm not trying to slag anybody, but I was curious, was Highlander 2, what was that shoot like?
Oh, for me, look, I come from a different level from a lot of ways, meaning that I was sought after, they were looking for a Steadicam operator, and I was recommended by Dean Simler to Russell Mulcahy. I was brought over there as a specialist Steadicam operator, and I met the DP, the English DP called, he's actually a very nice man. I've worked with him since up in Queensland on a film. Gee, I can't remember now. It's naughty. He's not sure to remember those names. He caught me offhand. Look, I'm at that point a crew member, so I had my own personal experiences. So very hard for me to comment. I enjoyed the shoot. I enjoyed the time I spent there. I was on one stint. I was going away to go and work with Rolf, and they did want me back, but I couldn't come back. Or they actually wanted me to stay, and I couldn't stay because I committed to Rolf. So the rest is history, really. But I did have a good time on the film. It was a big film, there's no doubt about that. And that's Panzer and Davies, isn't it? The producers. I enjoyed it. It's Argentina. But I'm the wrong person to ask in some ways. You know, the end film is what the end film is. We've all seen it.
I've seen multiple versions of it, which is crazy.
Yeah. I don't. Yeah. I'll leave it at that.
What have been some of your favorite films to work on?
I mean, fairness to, I think it's a, we call it Evil Angel. I think it's A Cry in the Dark in the States, isn't it? That film with Meryl Streep and Sam Newman. Yeah. Look, just to be around Meryl Streep, some funny experiences happened. She's such a golden girl. I mean, really, I can't, to be the operator on a film and you have her on the other side of the lens is just something I'll never, ever forget. I remember in a makeup test, you know, the back streets of Melbourne, funny little building, and she's come to town and we're going to do these makeup tests, and we all met her, you know, cautiously, but also met her with dignity and so forth. And then I put my eye to the viewfinder, and then there was this Meryl Streep that I'd seen on many, many, many films before, other many, many times, and just go, wow, aren't I lucky? And it never, and that, in all fairness, that never diminished every time Meryl was the other side of that camera. The respect was just huge, you know. And we all tried tricks. She plays games. It's just fantastic. Good games, I mean, you know, good, fun games and stuff. And so the relationship with the Australian crew with her was just gorgeous. And, of course, Sam, you know, and the Australian cast were just in awe of her. Yeah, absolutely. You know, Russia House took me to Russia. I ended up in Russia after that again, but just to go to Russia before the wall came down, we got silver service. I mean, I don't know who paid who or what, but just we put a camera on the back of we call them a tracking vehicle, but you'd call them just a flatbedded vehicle which you can put cameras on. What do you call them? There's another name for using the States. Oh, tracking vehicle, doing. And we drove through the streets of Moscow, and they had the power to turn the lights on and off, you know, like the green light on, the red light off at the street corners and so forth. And we'd be shooting all where, this is just before the wall came down. This is still communist China, communist Russia. And you're shooting buildings, you're rolling on buildings, which were, in all fairness, you know, you couldn't have done that 4 years ago. You would have been shot. So things like that, we just had the power. I don't know, I'll give Pathé and all of those, the producers who put whatever they put into place, but the magic things that happened, you know, and the Russian crew, the amount of food that we had as Westerners, and, you know, it's made up of Americans and English and Australian personnel, and you know, the food that we have, we'd stand back and let the Russians go first because they'd never seen such food in the variety and the quantities, you know. Just films like that, and to work with, I can't remember the German actor, the gentleman, the pilot in Russia House, a philosopher. People like, you know, those cast members, you just, they deliver something which is just gives a film the depth and the enjoyment of being there. You know, and it's, what we do is important, but it shouldn't, you know, the cast come first in my mind, and the opportunity for them to deliver, you know, the script is just magic.
So what are you working on now?
Well, funnily enough, I've been approached to involve with a documentary, which is actually the involvement of Indigenous actors in our film industry. Because one of the conceptions is, one wonders whether that how we perceive Australian Aboriginals, is that because of theatre and television and film? And when you actually look at how we see them, is that correct? And we have perceptions as white Australia of we've got stereotypical attitudes, and has that been caused by film? So it's a good topic. When the writer-producer director actually rang me, his name is he's done a number of Indigenous pieces of work. His name is Curtis Levy. I was quite stoked. I went, yeah, no, I like the topic. I love the topic. And interestingly enough, I get to probably meet a lot of Indigenous cast I haven't worked with, but I'd love to meet. And equally, there's a lot of directors there that have worked with these casts, which I've probably met socially, but not in this sense. So I'm looking forward to it, actually.
How did you get your start in the business?
I drifted into it, really. I guess it depends a little what you mean by the start. But look, when I was young, I went to uni and quit because it didn't work for me. And I ended up with a job as a storeman. Now, it just so happened that the storeman job was at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in Sydney. And I carted parcels and boxes and films around for 4 years or so. And thought, well, yeah, I've been here for 4 years. I might as well do something with it. And so then I got another little job and another job. And I ended up being a publicist at the ABC. And I didn't like that whatsoever. I hated being a publicist because by then that was a sort of substantial job. And they didn't want to start me again at the bottom. They wanted to give me publicity. And I thought, oh, well, I'm going to get out of here somehow. And I applied for the Australian Film and Television School, which was the sort of preeminent educational authority at the time, just been started, for film and television. And I got in somehow. And 3 or 4 days after I got there, I thought, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. I guess that's one of the starts.
Did you originally want to be a director or a writer, or what kind of turned you on?
At the time, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I applied to get in to the film school because you had to apply with a particular specialty. I just picked a specialty that I thought would give me the best chance of getting in, which was production. But fairly quickly, what I understood that I wanted to do really was to direct. And the thought of writing didn't occur to me because I didn't see myself as being capable, really. And that's just grown over the years, just by doing and doing and doing and doing. And until now, it's at least 50% of what I do.
How did Tale of a Tiger come about for you?
That was a peculiar one. That was really the first big break, I suppose you'd say. I was working with a company that, on my own terms, oddly, it's like a long story, really. I was working for a company for next to no money because that's how I wanted it. So it means they could never tell me to do anything. They could only ask me to do things. And the company was going broke. At the time in Australia, there were tax incentives for film. And there was one film that was a possibility of going that fell apart the second last day of the financial year. And that was the last chance to save the company. So the three who remained, the principal and another employee and myself, were going to meet the following day to split up the projects and sort of, you know, the company would go into receivership. But I got in first. There was one phone still connected by accident. Everything else had been cut off because there was no money to pay for anything. And a phone call came through which said, you know, do you have anything between $300,000 and $600,000 a project? And in fact, there was a documentary project that had been submitted to us by a Melbourne mob. And I said, yeah, we do. And by 5 o'clock that afternoon, there was $440,000 in the bank. And by 12:45, the contracts were signed, and it was meant to be a documentary about restoring a Tiger Moth aeroplane to be made by this Melbourne mob. But the financing was conditional, and the conditions couldn't be met somehow. So I said, look, why don't we change it into a movie, into a feature film? We'll make it a kids film. Kids are cheap. I'll direct it, and you know, you can produce it, and you can be the executive producer, and then at least we keep the money inside the company instead of this documentary mob. So that's what we did. And on the basis of that, we got a deal. On the basis of a screenplay that I then quickly wrote, 6 weeks, blah, blah, blah. We got the deal, we got the distribution deal, and we could then access the money and made the film. It did surprisingly well. I think it's gone into profit over the years, and I think the investors were well happy, but it doesn't make your second film any easier. It's not the sort of film that does, but it took another 3 years for the second film to come around.
What was kind of the atmosphere like when it came to filmmaking in Australia at that time?
It was pretty wild because the tax incentives were brought in because it was pretty was pretty small, but it was a revival, and it was interesting, and there were good films being made. And then suddenly the tax incentives came in, and they were meant to trigger perhaps $5 or $10 million worth of production, but within a year and a half, I think there was up to something like $200 million as the financial business took hold of this instead of the filmmakers. It used to be just the filmmakers running around with a suitcase trying to put some money together, but then the financial companies moved in because there was money to be made, and so they cut the tax deductions and everything collapsed. They cut them down. Everything collapsed. Films were falling apart all over the place, and blah blah. But then within a year, everybody worked out how to exploit the new lot, including a lot of people in America. This American company Hemdale was one of the worst offenders at exploiting this stuff. And then the government said, "Oh no, it's just $250 million coming out. No, I'll cut the tax deductions even further." So everything would collapse again, and until everybody worked out how to make them work again, and off they'd go again. It was, in a financial sense, it was cowboy country. And a lot of films were being made, and a lot were not getting released. And eventually they found a level for them that made it much more difficult for them to be exploited to the extent that they were. And the industry settled down quite a lot, but the 80s were a pretty wild time in Australia, and some good films made as well, and some big films, important films, and films that travelled enormously, like Crocodile Dundee, would never have been made without the tax concessions, and that's what it allowed at the time. And I think that one film probably paid for everything the government ever put into it, really.
Yeah, it was huge. One of the things that always impresses me is just how diverse your career is as far as the subject matter that you tackle. I mean, moving from Tale of a Tiger onto something like Incident at Raven's Gate, I mean, you wouldn't know that the same people were behind this. And then moving on to Dingo, I mean, it's just every film has such a different feel and tackles such different subject matter. Do you just have a wide range of interest, or do you just want to kind of challenge yourself?
There's a number of things involved, but one of them in particular is that, I discovered very, very early that making a film is exceedingly difficult if you're serious about it, and I am. And so why would you want to do the same thing twice? Why would you want to repeat yourself, keep repeating yourself? And so I do look for the new and the interesting, and what's interesting is something I haven't done before. In another sense, some things are reactions against what I've done before. So, one film I'll do and it'll be all outside, and I'll go, geez, that was horrible. It was rain. It was a studio filmmaker. And then you work in a studio, and you sit in the studio all the time, and you think, no, I want to get outside. So there's an extent of that. And to an extent, it's also circumstance, what happens to be going at a particular time. But also stylistically, what I do is when I'm onto a new thing, I try and leave behind everything I've done before, everything I've ever seen before, and quite sort of, I think a lot about how should this story be told. And it's about this story. It's not about having a style or about doing what I've learned before to do in a particular way and applying that to this. It's not about that. It's about trying to find something fresh and original for this one. And so I approach each film and each subject quite differently.
What was it like working with Miles Davis on Dingo?
It was very good. Miles and I ended up getting on extremely well, and there was a bit of luck in that involved as well. But we hit it off in a major way. And, in fact, we were talking about doing another film together that had nothing to do with music after Dingo. But obviously he died shortly after completing the film, so we never ended up doing that. We were talking about that because he was so good to work with, and he has a natural charisma. And I felt that if I wrote something that now I knew him, that he could really do something extraordinary, really be a very fine actor. Yeah, no, it was very good to work with him.
How did a movie like The Tracker come about?
The Tracker had a long gestation. It's partly Dingo. Okay, now Dingo was a difficult shoot. It was a big film, bigger budget than anything I'd done. 70 people in Outback Australia, it's difficult. And we had a week of shooting on that where we went right into the Kimberley, which is a very remote region of Australia, very beautiful. And I'd worked out how to do that, which with, say, a crew of 10, I think it was, and the two actors. And we had a safari tour organised, Aboriginal bloke, who would cook for us and put the tents up and all that sort of stuff. And so the 12 people, for a week, shot in regions where nobody had ever shot before. And it was a steady cam, and so we didn't have to bring dollies and things like that, so we could move the camera and do really good things. And spent a lot of time getting to a location, like climbing a mountain. Everybody has to climb the mountain, they do, but at the top it's wonderful. And it was the cheapest week of the film, and it was also by far the most enjoyable week of the film, and it was disproportionately valuable to the film. And I thought, to make a whole film like that, that would be the thing to do. And so that's where it started. It was just this concept in my head, not of a film, but how to make a film. And that concept sat there until the content came to meet it, which was I was doing research for a project I'd been commissioned to write. And it was Indigenous histories that were obviously quite unaware of. And suddenly those two things came together, what I was researching and the way to make a film. And suddenly this idea came into my head as to how to make this film. And in one little three-hour burst, I wrote an outline, say 12 pages, I think it was, and put it away because I was writing something else. And the other thing ended up stopping. And then I tried to write the screenplay, but by then Bad Boy Bubby was getting in the way. And in the end, the Tracker sat in the drawer for 10 years. Until I was asked, did I have anything of certain specifications? And the one thing I did have was the Tracker. And so out it came, and it was financed on the basis of the 12 pages. And then I could write the screenplay, which was then quite a different screenplay. The story was exactly the same, but quite a different screenplay to the one that would have been had I written it 10 years before. Because 10 years before, it was meant to be an intellectual discourse. And by the time I wrote it 10 years later, none of the characters wanted to talk, and there's always too much talk, so I cut it back and cut it back. And so then it had been quite a short script, but the length of the film was the same. And the songs came into it, and the paintings came into it, and it became exactly the story. And we shot it in very much that way that I'd intended, Steadicam even on the horse, we sort of built a rig for the Steadicam to go on the saddle. And it was great. It was a great way to shoot and a great place to shoot it, and it was a great shoot.
Was that your first time working with David Goldblum?
Yes, that was the first time I'd worked with him. And that was at the beginning of our relationship.
So much of that movie kind of lives or dies by its performances, and you got such great performances from all the actors in that one.
It was a great one to do. Gary Sweet's a very experienced actor, and he has this photographic memory, which is very useful. Damon Gamow, it was his first film. He was just out of acting school. And there was David, who was a bit all over the place, but he's the most extraordinary actor. Now, I thought about it, and I thought, well, we can shoot this largely in sequence, particularly with a small crew. That's very helpful. And in terms of the location, because it was sort of a journey thing, it needed to fit in a certain way. And so I worked to shoot largely in sequence, and particularly for Damon, the greenhorn, and he played a greenhorn in the film. And he could barely ride a horse because he damaged his leg just before the shoot, and he couldn't do his horse practice. But he got thrown on the first day, But you can see during the film that the character's confidence grows, but then so does the actor's confidence grow. And it's because we were shot in sequence. And he could build for his first film. He was so raw. By the end of the film, he could ride very well. And it shows in the performance. And it, really was helpful. And Diode is such a good performer. And Gary is such a giving actor to the other actors that he lifts them. No, it was wonderful.
He shot Bad Boy Bubby in sequence too, right?
Very largely, because that one we sort of had to, because he had to base certain parts of his performance on what has happened before. You never really know quite what's going to happen. And so, yes, we shot the studio stuff first, where he's locked up. And there's no reason, because you've only got, you've got him and Mom for the first week, and so you can shoot that in sequence. Doesn't make any difference. So you may as well. And because of the degrading of the place as well. And then Pop comes into his world, and you have him for the second week. So then you do the things that you do, like one of the things we did is the set, the place where he's living is almost 50% bigger once Pop comes, because it's sort of meant to sort of represent his horizon expanding. And nobody ever notices, but it's there. It's there, part of it. But so you do that. There's quite a big changeover. So you spend a couple of hours changing that over, and then you shoot the Pop stuff in this sequence, and then we go outside, and it's all local, and very largely we can shoot it in sequence. And you use many films you can't, and that's fine. You work out how not to, but if you can, it's really very helpful, particularly for small crews. And particularly for actors. I mean, it's a joy for them to be shooting in sequence.
How did a film like Ten Canoes come about?
Ten Canoes came about... it's a very long story. But the essence of it is that David had been asking me to make another film with him even before we'd made The Tracker. He would always carry on about, make a film up here being where he lived with my people. And because I'd visited him up there before The Tracker, I knew what the place was like. And it's not the sort of place you choose to go and make a film. It's extremely remote. It's very, very difficult with communications in particular, because up there few people speak half-decent English and there are no translators. And the mosquitoes and the heat and the crocodiles and the mud and the... it's just a very difficult place. And so there was no earthly way I was ever going to do that. But, one day thinking about things, and David again, constantly wanting to make another film and so on. And I was thinking about, the nature of Indigenous cinema in Australia, and we'd had this sort of glorious time of The Tracker and Rabbit Proof Fence and a few others. And what had happened, and that all stopped, and I thought, I know what you could do, but I'm not going to do it. And then, not shortly after that, I had to make a film, because the film that I was trying to get financed was clearly going to take a long time to get financed, and I couldn't afford that. And I thought, the only thing I could think of was to go up and make a film with David up there. But I thought, no, I don't want to do that. It's too hard. It's too hard. But then I couldn't think of anything else. And so I thought, I've got to get rid of this idea. So I'll introduce it to the office, and people will say, yeah, lost. We're not going to do that. And so I said, how about we make a film up there, with David and David co-directing, or make it in language and blah, blah, blah. And there's this deathly silence. So I thought, yeah, I've got them. They're going to say, get lost. And they said, what a fantastic idea. And then I had to do it, of course. And so I rang David and said, look, can I come and see? And 5 days later, we were virtually signed off on what we were going to do. That's sort of how that came about.
Yeah, I was very curious if you could understand what a lot of the actors were saying as they were saying it.
No, I could not understand what they were saying at all. And I had to trust that the communication that had taken place was good. And in the translations, it turned out that mostly it was very good. And that when we did the translations for subtitling, that mostly it came back to us exactly the way I'd intended. And there were people, as much as possible, keeping an ear open for this and an eye open for it and so on. And occasionally it would go wrong, like there's one section early on in the piece where we had the devil of a time trying to get translation going. In the end, somebody who was fresh came into it and said, look, He's just talking gobbledygook. He's talking rubbish. That's why I can't translate it. And he's talking rubbish because he doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know why he's there. Anyway, we were able to cut around it and make it work. Because ultimately it had to work for them as well. I wasn't just going to translate my words onto their different dialogue. It's not easy, but you learn to trust, and you're working with people who care about what they're doing.
I love the use of color in that.
Yes, the color and the black and white. That was a means of solving problems, and the problems were many and varied. But yes, once I struck on the idea of splitting it up into two time spaces and one black and white and one color, into the mythical past, then the film really started to come alive in a major way, because it was there was a sort of lack of drama in terms of what they wanted, because they didn't want old times to be depicted as a time of conflict. But once I thought about the mythical past, then that was okay. Anything could happen in the mythical past. Then we were able to retain the black and white, which has got this extraordinary sort of ethnographic and archaeological feel almost. Ethnographic, I think, is the best way, which they were very keen on, because there was an anthropologist who had worked out of there years and years and years ago, who'd taken these extraordinary shots. And so we were able to retain both that and get the colour going and get the conflict going, and have this film that was pretty interesting in its texture.
There's one moment in the film where it looks like one of the actors grabs the camera and kind of moves it more towards him.
Well, it's my spontaneous things. He was just in it, and so that's what he did. And I thought, okay, well, let's put it in.
Kind of takes you out, but at the same time, it's perfect. It just works so well.
Yeah. It's one of those difficult decisions you make in the edit, because it does break the fourth wall down. It smashes it apart, really. But it's such a good moment that you think, well, it's worth it. It's just worth doing it.
You have a film on your CV called The Balanda and the Bark Canoes. Is that kind of an offshoot of Ten Canoes?
It's a documentary. And it's a documentary about the making of Ten Canoes. It's not really, it's not a making of, it's a more sort of philosophical, cultural thing. But it's done at the time of the making of Ten Canoes. In the end, I'm only partly responsible for it, and responsible really for getting it into a mess, and other people pulled it out of the mess because we're just too busy and so on. And we ended up with 100 hours of dreadful footage, not all of it dreadful, but some of it was dreadful, and I just couldn't go on with it. And But it was salvaged beautifully.
Now, I know Ten Canoes was really critically lauded and won some awards and all this. How was it accepted, though, amongst the Aboriginal cult, the people that were either your subjects or other folks that saw it?
Oh, it's significant for them. It's exactly what they want. In some way, it's for them. It preserves an aspect of their culture that, and it puts it down in a really major way. And it's very, very good. They like it a lot. And it's generally recognized as being a significant film. It makes a contribution.
As an Australian filmmaker or a person who's making films in Australia, do you have to be really cognizant when it comes to your approach to Aboriginal culture? Do you have to kind of run it past folks to make sure that it's not going to be offensive or anything like that?
I don't do these things without really seriously looking after that side of things. With both Ten Canoes and Charlie's Country, I gave away creative control, because otherwise, there has to be ownership by them of this stuff. And if there's not, it's not going to work. I work very closely, their cultural advice and all this sort of stuff, but ultimately they have control. And if they say no, it's no. It's not even questioned. It's okay. Well, let's go somewhere else, or let's do something different, or what do you want instead? I'm sort of making it for them, not doing it for me.
We talked to Ian Jones a few months ago when we were doing our Bad Boy Bubby episode. It really feels like you're a very collaborative filmmaker when it comes to the whole process and being able to take people's ideas and, you know, kind of run with them. I mean, especially when it comes to something like Bad Boy Bubby, where you have all of the different cinematographers and all these different looks going on with it.
It's the best way to work, you know? For me, it's the best way to work. You get the most out of people if you're collaborative. If you sort of jump up and down and say, this is what you want, you don't give them much, do you? And you know, they can go into a whole different areas, like the cinematographers, like working with the Aboriginal people, that are two different aspects of the same thing. But even on a much more conventional film, there's a questioning system that I use for myself. And when somebody suggests something, or when somebody comes up with something, or when an actor does something that's not quite what you expect, or, you know, at any stage, when you're coming across stuff that you haven't thought of, or that you didn't want, or that you didn't expect, I ask myself, you know, is it better than what I thought? Is it worse than what I thought? Or is it just different? And most of the time, it's just different and just as good. No different, no better, no worse, just different. And if it is, then I always go with it, because it gives the person who's come up with it, it gives them something. And I don't lose anything. The production as a whole gains as people become more committed and part of the process of making it, and they give more.
I think one of the most surprising films that you've done, for me anyway, was Dr. Plonk. I was completely taken aback by it. I had no idea walking into the theater what it was going to be. And I was so glad I didn't, because it just unspooled and I was just sucked right in. Where did that one come from?
It was lovely. It was a lovely thing to do. It was a lovely film to make. Look, it came from having 20,000 feet of old stock that I didn't know what to do with. That's where it came from. And then suddenly one day I saw it. I saw this old stock, because some of it was like over 10 years old and it had been in the fridge that had broken down and the tins were rusting, and you just could imagine the stock being in dreadful shape. And suddenly one day I saw this stock unspooling with all its dye things gone wrong, and I was seeing a black and white silent movie. And I thought, well, why not? Let's do it. It was a joy to make as well. And you know, you can't make these things like they used to anymore, although in many respects we tried. I mean, we ended up with a hand-cranked camera, you know, so everything was hand-cranked like they used to. You know, occupational health and safety has shifted things quite a lot, and so you've got to be much more careful with stunts and all that sort of business. But still, it was great. There were times when there were just three of us, the cranking, the cameraman, the actor and I. And that's all you need. You know, you go, because the actors did their own costumes and makeup, you just walk off somewhere and do something like they used to do it. Yeah, no, it was great. It was a lovely big film to make. It was great. In the writing, but then working with the actors to push them further. It was a great shoot because I didn't know how long it was going to take us, and I knew there would be interference with the shoot because of 10 Canoes would probably go to Cannes and all this sort of business, and it was going to be a mess of a shoot. And so I just said, okay, well, 6 months. That's it, 6 months. It's going to take us 6 months, because it was crew. Yeah, maybe five people. That was it. And it meant that we could do things like, okay, there was a scene that was written simply by the police chase Plonk. Four words, the police chase Plonk. And there was a whole day set aside to do this. And I turned up on the day and I said, this is hopeless. Okay, you can go home, because it's a small crew, it's only two or three people at the centre. And the stuntman and the actors and I then spent the whole day working out what to shoot and how to shoot it. And we then spent 2 weeks shooting a sequence, you know, that had been scheduled for one day. Now, we could do that. And that's a great liberty, and that's not something you can normally do on a film. Yeah, it makes it good.
It seems like, kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation with the whole idea of the funding and all this kind of stuff, who's crazy enough to put their money into a modern day black and white silent film?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a bit soon, didn't it? Because the one that came a couple of years later made a shitload of money, which was The Artist, which I haven't seen. So in one sense, it's not such a crazy idea. Somebody else had the same idea, made a lot of money out of it. This costs a lot less than that did, and that's why people are crazy enough, because you think, oh, this could do something, but it's not going to cost a lot to find out.
Can you tell me a little bit about 12 Canoes?
12 Canoes is not really mine. That's Molly Reynolds. It's a website project. You can go to 12canoes.com.au, and there's a wonderful website there. But central to that website were 12 sort of more high-end little video stories, about 5 minutes each or so, 3 to 6 minutes, I think that. And the guy who was head of the Australian National Film and Sound Archive at the time, he happened to be over and saw, while the editing process was going on, saw two of those segments. And he said, look, we're building a new high-end screening facility in Canberra at the National Film and Sound Archive, and I'd like to open it with this stuff, because it's so great. So in the end, we joined the 12 up together, and they played as one piece. I mean, I didn't direct or produce. I did most of the writing for it, and playing them as one piece, they really worked. It was a strangely immersive thing, and the pace of it is very a la Aboriginal community up the top end, where the pace is of life is different than time is a different thing. And the film reflected that. And it actually went to Telluride and various other places and won all sorts of archaeological film sort of prizes. And, as did the website, in fact. So it was a big success, 12 Canoes.
It looks like, looking at your CV again, it looks like you did a whole lot of documentary shorts in 2008. Were those kind of related to that?
I think they must be ascribed to me. They must be the 12 segments of 12 Canoes.
There's like one called Jamming 1, Jamming 2, Songman 1, Songman 2, The Undertaker, Turtle Hunt.
No.
Okay.
They're even they're the low-end video ones on that same 12 Canoes website. I didn't do them. They're not me. They're all Molly Reynolds, not me.
Can you tell me, how did The King is Dead come about?
It came about in two ways. One is I was encouraged by the Film Funding Agency in Australia to apply for some script development money, which is not something I normally do. And for some reason, I said, yes, okay, all right, then I'll do that. Okay. And what I was going to do was there was a script I had previously written a long time before, back in early 90s, which had some traction for a while, which was to be shot in America. Miramax owned it at one point, and there's another mob who wanted to do it. It just never actually ended up going. And I was going to convert it into being Australian. And I tried to do that, and I failed. It was intractable. It didn't want to be turned into an Australian film. It didn't work in the same way, because the social conditions are different and so on. And the distances are different, and the population density is different, and it wasn't going to work. And so I said to the Australian Film Commission, look, I can't make it work. I'll give you your money back. And I said, no, just do anything. It's anything you want. It doesn't have to be that. It can be anything. Okay. And I thought about it. And I was living in a situation where I had six neighbours, and I was wandering around and thinking, okay. And it sort of started to come. And all the neighbours I'd ever worked with and so on. So I wrote the screenplay and I liked it, but then it went on the shelf, like many things do, for 2 or 3 years. And then suddenly the opportunity came to make a film. There was a gap in time, we were going to sell our house because we were going to move to Tasmania. And I thought, oh, we can do this here. You know, we can do it with the neighbours, with, you know, George on one side and Sam and Anna on the other side, and cut a hole in the fence, no worries, and it's all will work. And there's three houses next to each other like they are in the film. And so we did. So that's how that came about.
So a film of opportunity, kind of.
Yeah.
Did you go right from that into Charlie's Country?
Within 6 weeks of finishing the mix, or ten. Within 10 weeks of finishing the mix of the sound mix of King is Dead, I'd committed to David that we would be doing Charlie's Country and began to work on it full time. So, yes, it was a pretty quick turnover.
Now, that one's credited to you and David for writing that. Had you done a lot of collaborative writing at that point?
In terms of writing, it's collaborative in the way that Ten Canoes is collaborative in the writing, except that, you know, who puts the words on the page? I do, and in that sense, it's not. Okay, it's not two people running around with each other writing together. That's not how that works with David. But I had been, you know, I had several times before made a film to suit somebody else rather than myself. You know, Ten Canoes was a film that suited the mob rather than me. Dance Me to My Song was a film that was effectively made for Heather Rose and the way she wanted it to be. And we all felt we were making a film for, we were being the means by which she could make a film. So I'd had experience of doing that before, and that's what Charlie's Country became. Yes, there's a lot of my ideas in it, and I don't know which ones are mine and which ones are David's and so on, but it's as much made for what David would want it to be as is anything else.
That one seems to have gotten a lot of praise as it's been going through the festival circuit and playing different places.
Yes, I've now seen it in many countries of the world with audiences and done Q&As and things. And it plays very well. It gets a response almost everywhere that's much the same. Even though culturally, there are different things that attract different audiences. But the response of being moved and interested by it are the same. It's been a great and glorious journey.
What was it like to kind of come back and work with David after all these years?
Look, it was such an individual and a particular situation, that one, that what's it like? It's very different because David had given up drinking, and so the issues were all different. We had gotten to know each other a lot better over the years, and it was, yeah, as much as possible as his film. Yeah, to make him feel that it's his film, because that was important. Those issues, okay, the fact that David had been in jail when I began to talk to him about doing it, and for alcoholism and so on, actually in jail for violence linked to alcoholism, let's put it that way. But so that the film played a very different part in his life. It was very important to him. It was like it was his redemption. And so all the weights on it were very different. It was a very different process. And also to be making a film with David in Darwin and Ramen Ginning, which are, for him, about the two most difficult places in the world to make a film, because the obligations that are upon him are huge. That made things also quite interesting compared to before. Very different process, but look, it was in both the films that he starred in that I've done with him, he's fantastic in the films. So it's a good process. There must be something right about it, let's put it that way.
You said that a lot of the films that you've made have been kind of for other people. What do you consider ones... Yeah. Sorry, if I said a lot, I meant a few.
Yeah.
What are some of the ones that you consider yours, and what are the favorites of those?
Bobby's mine, in a way, for me, very much. It's the first film that's truly for me, although Tale of the Tiger in its own way was... But that was sort of so to fill a hole in a particular way. So Bubby was the first one. Epsilon, very much so. Quiet Room, very much so. Oddly, The Old Man Who Read Love Stories, though it's based on a novel, is in some ways pretty representative of who I am. Yeah, Plonk was for me. Yeah, one of my favourites. I don't look at them that way. I love them all. And look, you know, I've been most privileged to have made a number of films that have had serious, interesting traction. And you know, you think to have made one film like Ten Canoes would have been, you know, extraordinary in a life of making films. But you know, it was Ten Canoes, and it was Bad Boy Bubby, and now there's Charlie's Country, and there was The Tracker and Quiet Room and Bash Into My Song. They both went to Cannes in competition. It's like, whoa, one after another. It's just been incredible.
So I know you're traveling around Europe for a while, and now you're back in Australia. Are you working on the next one yet, or just kind of thinking about it?
Just kind of thinking about it, and I've got a trip to the U.S. coming up in less than 4 weeks, because the film Charlie's Country is going to make a bit of a theatrical appearance in the States. Stuff in the States for it.
Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. This has been great talking to you. I've really enjoyed it.
Okay, Mike. Thank you. And all the best with it all.
Back, and we're talking about Ten Canoes. Thanks to Mr. Jones and Mr. DeHare for coming on and taking the time to talk to us. And, of course, joined by our special guest co-host this week, Miguel Rodriguez. So, gentlemen, you did talk a little bit about Ralph DeHare and sort of your experiences with him. What other films have you seen recently of his, and which ones have had a serious impact on you?
You guys have been killing me this whole time because I have not seen Bad Boy Bubby. And I want to desperately see it now. No, it's great. Yeah, I'm glad, because I'm always happy to get a recommendation of a film I haven't seen. And I want to throw this puppy on as soon as we're done talking.
It's not the easiest watch in the world, because there's like a slight bit of violence against a cat. And I know that freaks Americans out a lot. And so some people end up talking about that movie in terms of a dead cat rather than looking at the entire film. And there's a lot more going on than that one scene. So it's a fantastic film. And the way that it was shot, the story behind the way that it was shot, makes it even more fascinating.
Well, the other thing about it is, too, is, and we talked about this on the show, so hopefully we get a chance to watch it and then maybe you'll listen to the episode, is that the first kind of 20 minutes have this sort of really dark, at least for me when I was watching it, I thought this was like one of those French brutalist films from the 90s. You know what I'm talking about? Like that whole era of just really dark stuff. I mean, like the opening just kind of reminded me of maybe like the opening of, I think I talked about I Stand Alone, about the guy who's the butcher who has this incestuous relationship with his daughter and like everybody dies in the end. And
it's that first Gaspar Noé film.
Yeah, and right. It totally looks like that. Like it's shot in this little room and it's really bleak. And then it turns the corner on you and you're like, what? and it's it takes a minute to get used to that turn, but you'll be happy for it.
Yeah, thank you for the film recommendation. I had no idea this film really existed, so I'm always thrilled to get a new film recommendation.
Yeah, and I have yet to see a DeHare film that I dislike. You know, everything that I've seen of his is memorable and striking in some way. Even if it's something like, you know, like a dark comedy like The King is Dead, it's not just a dark comedy. You know, there's a lot more stuff going to it. He really kind of, he makes you realize that there's a lot of stuff happening in the film, even though he's not going to beat you over the head with it, which I appreciate. But, I always go back to Dr. Plonk, which was his 2007 film, which I cannot recommend enough. It is a silent movie, basically shot as if it was made in the 1920s, I think it was, or maybe 1915. So it's shot like with an old camera, and talking about how this guy is going to go 100 years into the future. And obviously we were living in that time when, you know, he is going to go into this future world. So to hear him talk about, you know, going, well, and he doesn't talk, it's all with intertitles and everything. This very much is a silent film. And there's a lot of great kind of slapstick stuff. There's a lot of great visual jokes. It's a really good silent comedy shot in 2007 about a guy in 1907. So there's a lot of funny layers again going on with this thing. Have you seen any other of De Hare's work, Miguel?
I don't think so. I think Ten Canoes is my one De Hare film.
I also have to recommend The Tracker, which is another movie that he made with David Gilpilil. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen Charlie's Country, the one that he did in 2013, which is supposed to be fantastic, but I have yet to check that one out, and I'm really looking forward to that. I think he's still showing it around on the festival circuit. Maybe that's finally coming to a close. Luckily, David Gilpilil is getting a lot of notice from that, just from his performance. He also helped co-write, or at least he has a co-writing screenplay on that. I think it was more of a collaboration between those two guys, because Gilpilil, as I'm sure we all know on this podcast, has been working in films since the early 70s. You know, he was the black boy in Walkabout. So, you know, he's there. I think he was in his teens when he made that movie. And the reason why I call him the black boy is that's his character's name in there, or at least in the credits when that comes up. He's been in front of a camera for all of these years. I think that De Hare is the guy that worked with him the most of all directors, but he has been in so many different films. I want to say he was even in, because he was in like the Rabbit Proof Fence, mm-hmm. Crocodile Dundee, for God's sakes. He makes an appearance in The Proposition, which is another film I recommend, though not a De Hare film. So, and God, I think he was even in a Beastmaster TV episode. So this guy's been around for a long time and doing a lot of interesting work.
He's kind of your go-to for that kind of role, I suppose.
For which kind of role? For being the Aboriginal?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think he is like the face of Australian Aboriginals. I don't know what he would say about something like that, because to Rob's point earlier, it is kind of like, you know, it's a hot button topic after all these years still. I think it kind of comes in waves, and it's always fascinating to me to talk to filmmakers or people from Australia as far as their perception of Aboriginals, because that's probably so different for them than for people like us sitting here and talking about this movie, where we have, you know, it's another world. I don't think any of us on this podcast have been to Australia, and we definitely don't have, you know, 300 years of history to talk about when it comes to the white man's interactions with the Abos.
Yeah, a lot of it very ugly interactions as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that if you can make it through Rabbit Proof Fence without crying, I think you need to have your heart checked.
Yeah, you're a jerk.
So we covered Bad Boy Bubby, and it was a matter of like, I want to cover another Ralph De Hare film. And when we were going around about this, it was like, which one is it going to be? Because he does offer up so many great films to talk about. And it really was for me between Dr. Plonk and Ten Canoes, because, you know, you really can't get two different films when it comes to the subject matter of these movies. And Ten Canoes ended up winning out just because of that whole idea of the Aboriginals and everything. But really, he just offers a wealth of great movies to look at. And I'm hoping, like, I think for folks like us, he's kind of recognized as being a great filmmaker, but obviously he's not a household name.
I mean, I can't say how much I appreciate you asking me to discuss Ten Canoes, because this is going to be one of those things where I just have a Rolf de Hare marathon. And I really want to introduce myself to these films and maybe one day introduce other people to them as well. This is golden right here.
All right, we're going to take another break and play a preview for next week's show.
For the first time in screen history, a special interval will be provided during the running of this picture for refunding your admission. If you're unable to stand the almost unbearable suspense, the almost paralyzing shock of homicidal.
If homicide is your hobby, may I recommend a surgical knife for a nice, clean, quiet murder? I'm William Castle, and this wheelchair is just to rest my tired nerves after producing a picture like this one. We are so sure you will find it such a shocking and startling experience that we are offering a money-back guarantee when you come to see Homicidal. At the height of the suspense, there will be a fright break, an interval during which you can quiet your nerves. If you are too frightened to see the end of the picture, your full admission price will be refunded. Time to go downstairs now. Got a date to carve a corpse.
That's right, we're back next week. Kick off Shocktober month. It's William Castle's Homicidal. We'll be joined again by our good friend Jeffrey Schwartz, who will be talking about this Fright Fest, and make sure you get that insurance policy up to date. Before we go, I want to thank this week's special guest co-host, Miguel Rodriguez. Now, Miguel, you were just wrapping up your film festival. How did everything go, sir?
It was definitely our most successful year yet, both in terms of attendance and how much money we have left over to put toward next year. And the feedback we've gotten from both filmmakers and the audience has all been, to be perfectly honest with you, overwhelming. I get a little teary-eyed because my emotions are on overdrive after all the year of planning for this one. This is definitely the year I've worked the hardest on the film festival, and to have it come together so well in our new location. In this, I don't know if you've seen pictures of it on Facebook or anything, but we were at the Museum of Photographic Arts in Balboa Park, which is a museum. It's in a park, so it's a very unique location. And while that poses some problems, it also gives a very magical setting for especially a horror film festival. When it's nighttime and we're leaving the theater at 11 p.m., the park is technically closed, but they light up all these 100-year-old mission-style, very grandiose buildings with this stark blue light. It's surreal. Anyway, I think it went off very well with, you know, some minor technical problems that happen at every film festival. But everybody was very happy, and it just gets me planning for next year, I'm afraid to say.
I see that you showed Dell'Amore Dell'Amorte at the festival this year.
On 35mm.
God, that is such a wonderful film.
Yeah, and the beauty of that, whenever I do the repertory, because so at my film festival I always do newer independent, but I also have repertory because my mission statement is to showcase the variety that can, and also to elevate the perception that can be geared or thrown at the horror genre. And you can't really elevate or explore the genre without looking at the roots, right? You need to see what came before. You need to look at some classic films. And so this year I chose Dell'Amore Dell'Amore as one of my repertory. And because I was at the museum, they have a dual projector changeover system. And UCLA Film and Television Archive was kind enough to loan me their print for a 35mm screening. And it looked jaw-droppingly gorgeous.
The director of that is another guy whose work I need to look at a little bit more as well, because he's done some interesting things too. I mean, Dell'Amore, Dell'Amore, that was one of those weird ones where I couldn't believe that that got an American release under the name Cemetery Man, but I couldn't believe that it was showing at mainstream theaters. Like, I remember seeing it at the UA Oakland Mall, it's Oakland Mall, right? And just like, what? Why is this here? And then that is this outrageous Italian zombie comedy. It's like, okay.
Yeah, it's strange that it got that kind of release. It's kind of like I build it on the program as kind of being the swan song of the Italian art house horror film, you know, mm-hmm. in the vein of your Argentos or your Fulcis or Bavas or what have you. It's kind of the last of that era before the 90s kind of put an end to that. And in a lot of ways, it's an apex of quality, too. It's really something special. And when I asked the audience who had never seen it before, there was a lot of hands going up. So every time I do that, I get this thrill that is just in the pit of my stomach that there's all these people who are putting up their hands, who are their first experience with Dell'Amore, Dell'Amore is going to be on a big, gorgeous screen in 35 millimeter. And that there's just no better way. I'm also happy to say that on Sunday, my other repertory film, also on 35 millimeter, was Edgar G. Ulmer's Bluebeard. We had a panel discussion on the life of Edgar Ulmer just preceding that screening with Ulmer's daughter, Ariane Ulmer, in attendance, and his biographer, Noah Eisenberg, who I believe you recently had on the podcast.
Yes, he's been on for both our Detour and our Black Cat episodes.
I listened to both of them. They're great episodes.
How did the screening of Bluebeard go over? I would have loved to have seen that in 35.
It was amazing. And, you know, I've fostered an audience over the last 6 years of connoisseurs of the genre who are also willing to take chances and dip their toes into something new. And we've done classic repertory for a long time now. So this was not something unexpected of me, and everybody loved it. And everybody was coming up to Ariane afterward saying that only two people in the audience had seen Bluebeard before. And it was, you know, there were probably about 140 for Bluebeard. So,
wow.
Yeah. And so to have like 138 see Bluebeard for the first time on this rare 35 millimeter print, which was loaned to me by the Academy, is really a beautiful thing, because Bluebeard has been public domain for a while. And as you know, when these titles go into the public domain, they're available on a billion different DVDs and they look god awful. And I mean, John Carradine's voice and his eyes deserve to be seen in a restored glory. And the print looked really, really good. And the panel went off really well. In fact, anyone who wants to listen to the panel with Ariane and Noah, we did make a podcast of it. That one is is posted, and it's available now, actually, on my partner, Beth Accomando, my partner in the Film Geeks, Beth Accomando. She runs the Cinema Junkie. She's our local radio NPR affiliate radio station's arts and culture reporter. She has a podcast called Cinema Junkie, and she recorded the panel and posted it on her podcast yesterday. So anyone should go to kpbs.org/cinemajunkie to listen to that, like, right now.
Well, very cool. We'll definitely throw a link to that over at our website, projection-boot.com, as well as a link over to the Horrible Imaginings Film Festival website so people can go and check out the program. Is there anything that you showed this year that we should be on the lookout for as far as a feature or a short horror film that we should definitely have our radar going for?
I got to be honest with you, there's a ton. I showed, including the repertory, I think I showed something like 9 feature films and 67 short films. But
wow.
let me boil it down to, I could name some of the winners, for example. I want to mention Bunny, which is a 30-minute short film from the UK that is just an exercise in subtlety and haunting thriller, while also delivering us a villain that is worthy of like a Carl Boehm from Peeping Tom. You know, only she's a female. There's this woman in it who is a sympathetic villain, and the way that that the director Adam Awney crafted the film Bunny, I just adore. I think it's a wonderful film, and in fact, when we showed it, I'm not afraid to say, like, I had a tear running down my face as the credits started rolling, and I had to go up to the stage to because I closed that block with it. I recommend The Smiling Man also from A.J. Briones, which took home our Best Monster Show short. It's a 6-minute short film, very terrifying, starring a I think she's about a 6-year-old girl meeting a the embodiment of evil in her kitchen, and that went over really well. It's a really incredible short. Of course, there's a short that's hitting the waves pretty hard called El Gigante by a filmmaker named Gigi Saul Guerrero. And she's becoming kind of a next big thing kind of thing going on. But her short was very popular, and it's a lot of fun about a basically a luchador version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre family. And as far as features go, we had a film called Valley of the Sasquatch, which is always fun, starring Bill Oberst Jr. But the one that really was a crowd pleaser was an LGBT or a gay slasher movie called You're Killing Me by a director named Jim Hansen. And it's a horror comedy, and the horror stuff is pretty fun, but the comedy is just, dare I say, killer. Those are just a few, but definitely check out the program, because I got to say, I'm exceedingly proud of the program we put together this year. It was just stellar. There's so many good films that I highly recommend them.
Very cool. Well, thanks again, Miguel, for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And thanks to everybody for listening. You know, if you want to go over, we have delved into the world of Patreon. So we have a Patreon link over at our website. You can go over there, click on that, give us a couple bucks, feel better about yourself. We're actually getting close to being funded for at least 1 month. So wouldn't that be nice? That would really help take some pressure off of us. So that would be fantastic. So 1 month, it's a 12th of the way there. It's definitely a start. So for now, it is time for all of us to swim back to our water holes. Thank you.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.